I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we'll talk about perceptions of heaven, hell, and the afterlife, popular discourse, politics, and ordinary conversation. The catalyst for our conversation is a new master's class at Christian Theological Seminary titled, appropriately, Heaven and Hell and Salvation. My guests will be the course's professor, Robert Saylor, and Dr. Brent Heggie, instructor of religion at Butler. Please join the conversation. Please call 866-476-3881. Email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is nolimitswfyi. Twitter is wfyi. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're going to be talking about some important theological concepts today. We're going to be talking about heaven, hell, salvation, the afterlife, and much more. The springboard for the conversation is going to be a new master's course that's open to the public at Christian Theological Seminary. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. My guests are Robert Saylor, who is the executive director of the Center for Pastoral Excellence at Christian Theological Seminary and a CTS faculty member. He's also going to be teaching the course. And Dr. Brent Heggie, who is instructor of religion at Butler University. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
It's good to have you both here. So let's talk first about the details of the course, sort of how the idea came about first to offer it and then to open it, presumably, to the public. I'll start. Rob, would you be the right person to start with on that?
I'd be happy to talk about that.
Okay.
Christian Theological Seminary takes itself very seriously as a graduate school that's open to all. Certainly, we have a focus on training folks for various vocations within the church and the community, but we also have a real passion for bringing theological education at a much broader scope. So the idea came about 2 years ago to open some of our master's level courses to interested members of the public, and that could be clergy that are seeking continuing education, that can be folks who are members of churches and they'd like to go a little bit deeper, or it could be folks who have no particular religious affiliation at all that just want to know a little bit about what the study of theology is about. So 2 years ago we started doing this, and I've taught courses like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, focusing on his life and writings. Last spring, we did a course on C.S. Lewis. And this time out in the fall, we'll be doing this course on heaven, hell, and salvation, looking at it both in terms of how those themes have played out in the history of the Christian tradition, but then also how they creep out from the limits of church discourse and find their way into popular music, literature, movies, all of these other kinds of discourse that shape our lives. So we'll certainly be reading some Christian authors, past and present, but we're also going to be looking at artifacts from popular culture. One of the things that I'll be doing is to invite students to bring that in wherever they encounter it. And so it's really been a great experiment to open these courses up to the public. As someone that's been a pastor myself and has taught seminarians for a while, it's wonderful to watch them interact with members of the public, both the sort of people that show up at church on Sunday morning and the folks that would perhaps never think to show up at church on Sunday morning, and to read these texts and to engage these ideas together. It becomes, I think, a nice spin on the education of a church or community leader. And meanwhile, I think at the seminary, we've been very gratified and impressed by the hunger that we've determined out in the public to really engage heavy texts and heavy ideas. Since these are master's level classes, I don't skimp on the reading.
Who are some of the authors, the books that you're going to be reading? is part of the class.
Sure. In the Heaven and Hell course, we'll take a look at some of the classics. Dante, Jonathan Edwards, his famous sermon, Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God. But then we're also
cheery stuff.
Yeah, exactly. But then we're also going to look at some of the places where the lines blur between theology and popular culture. For instance, N.T. Wright is a theologian that is very accomplished in the academy, but his book on heaven is one that got him featured on the Colbert Report, an interview with Stephen Colbert. Another classic example would be Rob Bell. His book, Love Wins, was a phenomenon in the evangelical world. It made the cover of Time. That's another instance where what starts off as theological discourse finds its way into a broader public, and it sparks really interesting conversations. My favorite book title that we're reading is, there's been a lot of talk over the years of the quest for the historical Jesus. We're reading a book called The Quest for the Historical Satan, which takes a look at how ideas of what a demon is, what Satan is, have evolved over time and in different contexts. I think the students are going to get a kick out of that one.
And I do want to dive into that. But Brent, I think one of the areas that I have always found fascinating in terms of talking about heaven and hell is the way that what you talk about as the creep, the reference to the creep, how it creeps out. There's also some creep back, too, that, you know, when they move out into popular culture in particular, the perceptions of what heaven is and what hell might be are shaped also by what you see in films or in literature, and then that begins to shape the at least the popular theological conceptions of what those might be. I guess, you know, how do you track at some level, you know, what started out as a theological concept and, you know, what was a popular phenomenon and where did they start to mix together?
That's a good question. One of the tasks of a theologian, and Rob and I are both trained as Christian theologians, one of the tasks of a theologian is to sort of straddle the line between the church and the culture. And so one of the things we do to sort of keep track of that creep, as you call it, is to be students of popular culture. Watch those films, read those books, listen to those songs, and because the people who we're teaching and who we're interacting with are doing that, and they might be getting more from those than they get from people trained in theology. And of course, you know, for Christian theologians, the task is to interpret or translate the faith into the idiom of the day. And so one of the ways that people process things is through popular culture. And so that's part of our task, is to understand the language they're using and the sort of presuppositions they have or the assumptions that they have and show where they might fit and where they might not fit.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about, believe it or not, heaven, hell, and salvation. The springboard for our conversation is a new course, master's level course, that's open to the public that Christian Theological Seminary, CTS, is offering. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. So let's take a step back then and, in effect, try to take people into what this course, where this course might begin. Let's talk about the origins of sort of human conceptions of, first, we'll start with the good stuff of heaven first. Okay, we'll go in the other direction after that. How did heaven as a concept first manifest itself, Rob?
One of the things that becomes very fascinating when you look at the Christian tradition is that you realize that from the get-go and unapologetically, the early church did not understand itself to be inventing these ideas from whole cloth, but rather incorporating the best of what was around and bringing it into what the church decided was the key narrative of history, which was the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. One very important biblical image that became crucial for the early church fathers comes from the Exodus account, where there's a reference to plundering the spoils of Egypt, that is, taking the Egyptians' goods out of Egypt when the Israelites escape. The early church fathers applied that to philosophy and religion, actually, and said, whatever is around, either in the pagan world, stemming from other religions, that's useful for articulating the gospel, we're going to take it, and we're going to take it unapologetically, and we're going to see it as crucial to the gospel. To the question of how conceptions of heaven came up, crucial figure in that regard would be Plato, of course, who many of the early church fathers were explicitly Platonist or Neoplatonist. Plato's notion of reality, material reality, as in some respects a copy or a lesser emanation from a more primal reality that is immaterial, that is spirit, for the early church fathers became a kind of Rosetta Stone by which to understand Paul's language in the New Testament about the spirit of the law as opposed to the letter of the law. So with that in mind, the early church was able to read Jesus's talk, hear Jesus's talk about heaven, the kingdom of heaven, as the goal of Jesus' ministry, as something that would be primarily immaterial, that would be somehow above and beyond the material world in which we find ourselves. So that's one instance of a crucial source from the surrounding culture, from surrounding learning.
And I guess maybe I'll throw this one to Brent, but allow Rob to jump in too. To some degree, I probably was a little sloppy in the question in asking it. It does strike me that you're right. The notion that there might be life after this earthly life is not a Christian invention. Our concepts or beliefs in an afterlife, as old as humanity, have we been able to trace back the origins of when people began to believe that there would be an afterlife? I'll start with you, Brent, but then I think that seems to be part of where this goes, too.
Well, one of the things to say to start this off is, and this is something that always bears repeating, is that the Bible is not so much a book as a library. Mm-hmm. It's a collection of texts from a lot of different times and places, from different authors, written to different communities about different issues. And so we can trace some of the history of these ideas or these doctrines through the biblical narrative and see sort of where they happen. Curiously enough, there really isn't much of a sense of the afterlife in the earliest text in the Hebrew Bible or the Old Testament. You see a focus on this life, and the most you get about something happening after death is that you're gathered to your ancestors. Mm-hmm. Slowly you start seeing a sense of something happening longer. You get a sense of this idea of Sheol, or the underworld, the place after death. It's not until the Jews are taken into exile in Babylon in the 6th century BCE and they hook up with the Zoroastrians in Babylon and further east in Persia that they start getting a sense of a soul that somehow outlives the body. Mm-hmm. And that's when you start seeing this attention to an afterlife, either a heaven or a hell. But to this day, Jews don't place that much emphasis on it. Christians and Muslims in the Abrahamic tradition are the ones who really, traditionally anyway, have placed an emphasis on heaven and hell. And so you can see it in the New Testament, but you also get a sense in the New Testament that heaven is more than a place. It's somehow also something that's a potential reality here and now. You see Jesus proclaiming that the kingdom of God is at hand, for example. And so you can see the early church sort of playing around, like Rob said, pulling from other traditions, but also doing something unique. And so you can trace the history of the idea of heaven, for example, that way, through the biblical narrative.
And were there cultures that predated, obviously, the Jewish faith, which predated, obviously, the Christian faith, that also had a concept? Are we able to track back, Rob, I'll throw this one to you, when first in humanity people might believe that they would outlive in some form their earthly experience.
Anthropologists are fond of saying that we've never become aware of a culture that didn't have something akin to what we would describe as a religion. Okay. Now, one of the things that's tricky about your question is that there's a real interplay in, I think, in all religion, between to what extent is religion meant to reconcile yourself to this world and its natural rhythms and patterns, and to what extent does religion teach a kind of escape from this world? And I think that we see that tension going back, as you suggest, as far back as recorded history.
It's sort of a central tension of being part of the human
race. Exactly, exactly.
So if you are just joining us, we are talking about Heaven, Hell, and Salvation. That's the name of a new course that Christian Theological Seminary is offering. My guests are Rob Saylor, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Pastoral Excellence at CTS and is teaching the course, and Dr. Brent Hege, an Instructor of Religion at Butler University. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about Heaven, Hell, and Salvation. That's the title of a new course, new master's level course, that is open to the public, being taught at Christian Theological Seminary. My guests are Rob Saylor, who's the executive director of the Center for Pastoral Excellence at CTS and is a faculty member. He is teaching the course, and Dr. Brent Hege, who is instructor of religion at Butler University. We are taking calls. Mike, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I want to say I appreciate the topic and appreciate the position where the two professors are. It seems to me, though, that probably what I've heard so far would not resonate with a 75 to 80% of people who call them Christians in the Indianapolis area who are more conservative bent. And I wonder two things. How come you didn't include some popular work like 90 Minutes in Heaven, which comes more from that perspective? And secondly, if you do have such people who come to your class, how will you avoid treating them with looking down upon them with contempt, I'll put it that way.
Condescension. not treat their views with respect.
Yes.
Okay, I will. We'll get an answer for your question. Thanks very much for the call and the question, Mike.
Sure.
Rob.
I very much appreciate the question, and it's one that I think a lot about. I think that students that have me in class will testify to the fact that it's actually incredibly frustrating to get me to finally come down in one place or another as to what I personally believe. That's not to say I don't bring my own biases and my own lenses to the course, but what I try to do in a classroom is to create a space where people from multiple strands of the Christian tradition, or again, no faith at all, can feel like their views are respected and that they're being heard. What I'm passionate about is showing students that whatever their position is, ideas do have histories, in addition to having consequences, and that the Christian tradition from the get-go has been wildly diverse as far as how thinkers have approached these things. Wherever it is that students finally locate themselves on that spectrum, I celebrate that, and I hope they feel that they have more information on the basis of being able to contextualize their ideas within the broader stream of tradition. As far as the readings go, we are reading C.S. Lewis's Great Divorce. One of the things that I love about C.S. Lewis is that he's an author that Christians of multiple stripes, from the most conservative to the most progressive, can find something in there, both to cheer them and also to provoke them. And really, the discussion around Rob Bell, including the critiques of Rob Bell, that really was an event primarily in the evangelical conservative world. One of the striking things about what happened when Love Wins came out is that there was this massive uproar among evangelicals, and there was kind of a shrug among other kinds of Christians, because in a way, Bell was articulating a position that was very familiar to them. And part of the point of the class will be actually to examine just that. Why is that, that this discourse plays out so passionately in some areas and has been marginalized in other places?
We've got an email from a listener, and if you'd like to reach out to us by email, you can do so at nolimits@wfyi.org. This is from a regular listener named Jerry. He says, as a devout secular humanist, I am convinced that heaven and hell are useful constructs to describe states of mind. I actively dispute their material reality. Would such a person be welcome in your class? Would his eminently reasonable and questions and comments be welcome? Just asking. And then he follows up with, when and where will heaven and hell be held? And how much? That's a pretty heavy theological question, actually, I think. But where will the class be held? And how much does it cost to attend? So it's a question actually from the other end of the spectrum, which is going to create a follow-up for me. But
sure.
If you can answer Jerry's question real quickly.
I'll answer the latter question in the most materialist way possible and say that the class is going to be from 6:30 to 9 p.m. on Tuesday nights at Christian Theological Seminary, which is located at 1000 West 42nd Street, right next to the campus of Butler University, starting this coming Tuesday. And anyone who's interested in registration can go to our website, www.cts.edu, and find information there. I'll mention, too, that for people taking the course not for credit, the fee is just $200 for the entire semester. So that's the materialist answer to the when and where. And yes, as far as the question of who's welcome in the class, it's the flip side to the previous answer. Absolutely. We are a crucial part of the narrative of heaven and hell has been the influence of secular humanism on how this speech has played out. If you think about the end of the 19th century and the influence that folks like Nietzsche, Marx, and Freud have had upon the Christian tradition, not simply as an occasion for Christians to defend themselves, but I think more interestingly as an occasion for Christians to be forced to articulate their positions a little bit better in order to avoid the traps that Nietzsche, Marx, and Freud rightfully point out that are easy for Christian talk to fall into. There was the great song of 1911 by Joe Hill, the folk singer, called The Preacher and the Slave, but it's the parody of the hymn In the Sweet By and By. The song is called The Preacher and the Slave, and this is where we get our phrase, there'll be pie in the sky when you die. Mm-hmm. And that was a protest song by Joe Hill who was very influenced by Marxist ideas, saying it's so easy for Christians to talk about these realities, heaven and hell, in a way that not only devalues the present life, but actively supports oppression. In other words, keeps people from protesting against bad conditions in this life with the promise that somehow it will all be better when they die. I think Christians not only ought to take that very seriously, but ought to agree wholeheartedly with that critique and to adjust our talk accordingly. So absolutely, those perspectives are not only welcome, but warmly invited.
Is that a challenge in teaching this course? I mean, we've seen from these two questions, really, that whole idea of, okay, in some ways, you're talking about the third rail here when you talk fundamental beliefs that people have, bedrock, the things around which they order their lives and their approach to life. And you're, in effect, saying, okay, we're going to ask you to come into this class and at least for a moment suspend what might be a natural reaction to us questioning some of those concepts, to look at how they might have evolved. Is that a challenge in terms of teaching people, you know, A, about the history of religion, but about honoring certain religious concepts, even if they don't necessarily agree with them? Brent, I'm going to start with you, but I want to hear Rob's thoughts on that as well. Because that seems to me to be a fundamental challenge in approaching this course and this material.
It's a fundamental challenge for the course. I'm sure Rob will handle it with aplomb, as he always does. But, you know, it's a fundamental challenge teaching any religion course, really. religion is one of those things that is so sort of existentially meaningful, not just intellectually, although it is intellectually meaningful as well. And so when we teach religion or theology, we're inviting people to share the deepest part of themselves. Mm-hmm. And to also, you know, because we are scholars, we're also asking them to submit those to critique and to questioning and to wrestling. And in some traditions within Christianity or other religious traditions, that's something that's encouraged and celebrated, and in other traditions, not so much. And so I think as we grow as teachers, we get used to how to navigate that depending on where students are coming from. But it's always a challenge, but it's also an invigorating kind of process.
Well, Rob, I would think particularly with this class, since it is based on bedrock principles here that people adhere to, you're tiptoeing through a minefield when you talk about some of these things.
You're absolutely right that it's the challenge, but as Brent indicates, it's also the joy, and not only the joy, it's also the passion, and I think the work that has to be done. I'm one of those folks that thinks that one of the dangers of all sorts of discourse in our time, not just religious, but also political, is what we might call the hyperlinking of news. That is, we only click on the stuff that we're already interested in, and in that way, we deal with narrower and narrower tunnels of information to where we're finally only talking to folks that think the way we do and hold the same presuppositions that we have, trying to create a space where in a humane, inquisitive, and open way, some of those barriers come down. You know, for instance, I'm a pastor myself. I'm an ordained minister in the Indiana-Kentucky Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America. I see creating spaces like this as my ministry. In the same way that when I used to pastor churches, that was my ministry, creating a space in which these third rail topics, these live wire topics, can be addressed in a way to where, as the callers asked, everyone feels like they're being respected, everyone feels like they're being challenged at the same time, and the end result of it is a kind of humane experience of communication. That's definitely what we're about at the seminary. It's definitely what we're about in this sort of course.
Do you encounter resistance to that kind of approach? I'm going to ask both of you because you both are classroom teachers, and I'll say as in the bulk of my life I am a college professor myself, that I will hear from students, you know, no, I'm not going to consider that because I just don't agree with it. It offends me, and I will try to say, I'm not telling you not to be offended, but, you know, for example, if you're a scholar, you can read Mein Kampf, you can be offended by it. You still have to understand its significance. You have to understand, you know, what the intellectual underpinnings were that led to this huge convulsion in the in the middle of the 20th century. And, you know, frankly, in this context also had an important effect on just about every major faith tradition, too.
Right.
How do we reconcile having something like that happen? How do you get past that, no, I'm not going to consider it because it bothers me or it offends me argument? You know, which, you know, at some level was a subtext in the questions we got, too. If I don't believe, how do I have to consider it? Rob, I'll start with you, and I'm going to let Brent deal with that one as well.
Sure. I think that the more we invite people into a space of relationship, not only with other people in the class, but also relationship with a text, then the point is not to ask them to tamp down their passions and their strong feeling about the subject matter, but actually channel them in a way that helps them articulate it better and but also with more clarity and more charity. One of the reasons why I'm passionate about academic work in religion is because I think that the most basic art of a scholar, which is to be able to articulate a position with which you may happen to disagree passionately, but you articulate it in a way to where the person who holds that position says, yes, you've heard me. Yes, you've got me right. I couldn't have said it any better myself. And to do that before you then launch into what may well be an impassioned and vociferous critique of the position, that's not only a fundamental academic art, it's a fundamental human art. I think it's also a fundamental religious art. The idea of interpreting another's position with charity, mm-hmm. you know, it may sound fluffy and nice, but it's actually gritty, grueling, intense work. I think that the people who have this experience of having to engage in that sort of dialogue come out of it, not necessarily having their opinions radically altered, and again, that's not actually the goal, but rather they have their opinions enhanced in mm-hmm. ways that are more informed and more humane.
Mm-hmm. Brent?
Well, for me, education, at least in part, is about transformation. It's also about knowing what we believe and then why we believe it. And like Rob said, being able to articulate it. And so the way I design my courses, for example, it would literally be impossible for you to agree with everything we read, mm-hmm. unless you're not paying attention. And so you will be challenged, and I think that's an important part of education, is to come up against something that strikes a chord deep within you that says, I don't like this. Mm-hmm. But being able to push through that and to understand, okay, why am I feeling this way? What is it striking in me that's making me have this reaction? And that usually helps someone to articulate better what they actually do believe. And so without that challenge of reading or discussing something that strikes us as very wrong, that potential for that kind of learning isn't really there. And another thing that Rob said that struck me was the hyperlinking of the news. We have a tendency to only sort of listen to or read something or engage with people who already agree with us. And that's, I think, very dangerous in an educational environment. This is not what education is about, and that includes religious education.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Heaven, Hell, and Salvation. That's the title of a new master's level course at Christian Theological Seminary that is open to the public. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. Well, we've talked a little bit about sort of the conceptions of how the afterlife began, and you know, we've sort of established that there was at least some faith in it for as long as we're able to trace back to human history, at least some vague conception of it. How has it evolved over time? I mean, how did we get to, for example, the popular conception of heaven as a place in the clouds with a guy with a long gray beard and hell as a guy with a goatee and, you know, horns, and all of that. How did that take shape? Rob, I'll start with you.
The first thing to say in response to that would be to think about the influence, especially in the West, of two of the great geniuses of not only the Christian tradition but the literary tradition, and that would be Dante and then also Milton, John mm-hmm. Milton. I think we've all had the experience of hearing someone confidently describe the geography of hell or the nature of heaven as if it's right there, say, in the Christian Bible, and you realize they're actually describing part of Dante or mm-hmm. a chapter from Milton. The absolute poetic genius of these men too, and their literary and Christian imagination gave so much flesh and vibrancy to some of these images that it's and by giving them vibrancy, they not only shaped how they were perceived, but they also upped their importance within the Christian tradition. You also have to talk about economics in the medieval period, conceptions of the afterlife, how to have death go well and the afterlife go well. As we know, we're intimately tied up in the economics of the church, in the politics of Christendom. Those of us who are... You know, as a Lutheran, I'm an heir to the Reformation, which began as a protest and against an economic arrangement related to purgatory, right? Martin Luther critiquing the sale of indulgences. So all of those factors have to be taken into account.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about a new master's class at Christian Theological Seminary titled Heaven, Hell, and Salvation. It's open to the public. It's going to be on Tuesday nights. My guests are Rob Saylor, who's the executive director of the Center for Pastoral Excellence at CTS. And as a CTS faculty member, he is, in fact, the faculty member who will be teaching the course, and Dr. Brent Heggie, who is instructor of religion at Butler University. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at WFYI. I'm John Kroll. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StateHouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking about heaven, hell, and salvation today on No Limits. That's also the title of a new master's level course at Christian Theological Seminary that's going to be offered on Tuesdays and is open to the public. My guests are Rob Saylor, who is the executive director of the Center for Pastoral Excellence at CTS and a CTS faculty member. He's teaching the course, and Dr. Brent Heggie, who is instructor of religion at Butler University. We were talking just beforehand about how the sort of popular conceptions of God in heaven and the devil or the Satan figure emerged over time. To some degree, though, I mean, Dante's treatment was designed to be somewhat horrific. Anyone who's read Milton realizes that's not exactly a laugh a minute either. So I guess where I'd like to go from here is that there, at some point, these figures and these perceptions also were offered up for comic effect too. I mean, anyone who has seen some of the cartoons of the Bugs Bunny variety and all of that, whenever hell is presented there, it's presented for comic effect, and Satan or the devil really isn't all that frightening a figure. I mean, at what point did these perceptions start to become softened? I'll go with Brent.
Well, probably around the time that Christianity lost its dominance in the marketplace of ideas, probably around the Enlightenment is when that would have happened. One of the bedrock principles of the Enlightenment was that dogma and suspicion, they called it, or superstition or supernaturalism was seriously suspect. And so it was the age of reason, the age of science, and anything that couldn't be sort of empirically verified or was asking us to submit to an authority just because the authority says so, which obviously included religion in the Enlightenment period, sort of took some of the inevitability or the obviousness out of Christianity's dominance. And it's been that sort of that back and forth between those two sort of thought worlds has been taking place ever since. And so in some ways, though, it predates that. I mean, Milton and Dante predate the Enlightenment. Although there was a bit more in the Catholic tradition, the medieval Catholic tradition, there was a bit more comfort with humor related to Christianity in certain circles. That's not quite the case in other parts of the Christian tradition historically. So the history of that is fairly complicated. But you're right that there is some sense of these things showing up in cartoons a lot or in jokes. There's how many devil or St. Peter jokes have you heard in your life? A lot. Mm-hmm. And so there's something about that signals that maybe these are very important ideas for us that we can't always take too seriously, but that we keep telling these jokes and telling these stories. And so there's something resonating there.
And Rob, my question actually now goes in it. In a different direction, because you'd referenced you're a Lutheran. Mm-hmm. One would think also when the Christian faith became less of a a monolith, and I'm referencing the Reformation here as sort of the great split or the point where, you know, there was the river, you know, went off in two branches, and now there are many, many different branches and a lot of rivulets and all of that of stuff to extend the metaphor. What did that do to concepts of heaven, hell, salvation, and the afterlife? I would assume that it means that there are many more varieties of belief or faith in those concepts.
It's I think we can tie the answer to that question back to the previous one, related even to comedy, because things like comedy, philosophy, and literature, one way of looking at them is they are very human responses, deeply human and humane responses to when religion becomes inhuman and inhumane. And that's certainly the story of the aftermath of the Reformation. When it was understood in the medieval church that salvation was linked to being in full communion with the true church. Mm-hmm. And prior to the Reformation in the West, everyone knew where the true church was. You didn't have to go looking for it. Mm-hmm. After the Reformation, a real existential crisis comes up for believers. They still believe that to be saved means to be in communion with the true church. It's just now no one agrees where the true church is, which one of these different strands is it. The result of that...
It even goes beyond to some degree. It says, okay, we don't know who the true church is, and because we can't identify that, why don't we just start our own?
Right, right. And one of the results of that, not only is the proliferation of churches, but it's also violence, right? The great mm-hmm. wars of religion and so on. I'm one of those folks that thinks that the Enlightenment and the rise of what we might call secular human reason is, in fact, among other things, a protest against the violence mm-hmm. associated with the mm-hmm. the Reformation and its aftermath, to where you have figures like Kant and Lessing and Descartes saying, our job is not to just simply listen to what the church tells us. Our job is to think for ourselves. And in thinking for ourselves and in growing more of a tolerant attitude towards people that disagree with us, that's going to stop the bloodshed that we see around us. So I think that... And that naturally has what we might call a secularizing effect, but I'm actually very sympathetic to that secularizing effect, precisely because it's an indictment of how the church became party to violence, to existential threats. You know, you had folks excommunicating each other right and left. It was actually a very important corrective upon a particularly dark time in the church's history. And so I think not only Enlightenment reasoning, but also mockery, comedy. let's give the most human possible response to this, which is to have the ability to laugh and to revel in the gift that is life. That becomes a key theme here. And I think you can directly trace that then to something like God as a bearded white guy on The Simpsons, or the devil making an appearance on South Park. Mm-hmm. You know, it's just there's a real sense not only of I don't see that as cheap thrills. I see that as a sense of religion's most violent impulses can be kept in check, among other things, by retaining the ability to laugh. Mm-hmm. So I value them, actually, mm-hmm. for that reason.
Do you include in the class, or did you consider including some of the great skeptics about, you know, notions of heaven, hell? I'm thinking, you know, at least in this country, in this tradition, you know, some of Mark Twain's later work, or you know, his angrier work. You know, if that would be part of the class and part of the discussion as well.
Absolutely. One of, you know, we mentioned Dante earlier, and one of the keys to the course, and one of the reasons I decided to teach it, actually stemmed from reading some comments on Dante by the great 20th century literary critic Eric Auerbach. Auerbach had a wonderful title for Dante. He called him the poet of the secular world. And what he meant by calling Dante the poet of the secular world is that even though Dante is ostensibly writing about issues of heaven, hell, purgatory, the afterlife, he places such value on the actions that these various characters took in life and gives and takes seriously the idea that those actions gave these characters their identity, not only in life but in eternity, that Auerbach's point is that Dante actually becomes the greatest celebrator of earthly life and the importance of the world as we experience it. That, to me, creates a space for saying, you know, really when we're talking about heaven, hell, purgatory, salvation, we might think that we're being very speculative and talking about things that we have no real grasp on. But if you look both at Christian theology and then certainly in culture, what we're actually talking about are the things that matter most to us on earth. What is a good life? What is, how far can forgiveness go? How do we relate to someone who has committed an evil beyond our capacity to even imagine forgiving? All of those are very pressing day-to-day questions that are addressed by this discourse of heaven, hell, and salvation, however sideways that connection might be made. And so to your question about, you know, do you include the skepticism in that? I think the skepticism is crucial because it's not just an either-or. It's a matter of all of these things playing into how this discourse becomes a way of addressing the things that matter most to us in life.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about Heaven, Hell, and Salvation. That's the title of a new class offered by Christian Theological Seminary. It'll be offered on Tuesday, starting next Tuesday. It is open to the public. We're talking with the course instructor, Rob Saylor, and Dr. Brent Hege, who's an instructor of religion at Butler University. What do you think the most important thing or the most difficult thing? Well, those are two different questions, so I'm going to ask each of you this. Most important thing and the most difficult thing for people to grasp about the study of any sort of conceptualization of an afterlife, whether it is heaven or hell, and then what is the most difficult piece of that for people to wrap their heads around? Brent, I'm going to start with you, and then I'm going to go to Rob.
Well, I guess it's not fair to just say ditto to what Rob said before that, but I love that response. The idea, and this is not just these concepts, but a lot of religious concepts are ways for us to give voice and shape to what matters most to us. I'll refer to a phrase from a very significant 20th century theologian, Paul Tillich. He says, you know, what ultimately concerns us, what orients us, what shapes us, what forms us, what gives us meaning and direction. And religious language is one of the ways that, it's the only way, but it's one of the important ways that people do that. So I really do think that's why these concepts are so important, because they have a long history, they have a complicated history, but we keep coming back to them. We keep coming back to them. What's most difficult about it, I think, is the not knowing. Mm-hmm. That's difficult, but it's also an invitation to engage them. They're inviting us into a process, not giving us necessarily a pat answer. Although they're often shaped that way. They're often presented as answers when really I see them more as invitations. Mm-hmm. And that can be difficult because we don't like not knowing.
Rob.
As far as the most important thing to grasp, I think for myself I would answer the question. I think religious language, philosophical language, so much of what we engage in is ultimately to try to answer the question, can we have hope? And again, hope is not a light, airy, fluffy thing. Hope is the thing that allows us to keep going when we turn on the news and see acts of horrific violence, and also just random suffering, things that we humans do to each other and things that are done to us that are easy to create despair in us. And so I think that this language is not only a way of getting at the question, what is a good life? How are we to live? but also the more primal question of, is it all worth it? can we have hope that's not delusion? That's one. The most difficult thing, I think, is finding a way to genuinely honor perspectives that we don't finally occupy. I'm not someone that thinks that all religions are the same. I have very strong theological opinions. I think some answers are much, much better than others. But I also think that it's crucial to honor that with which we disagree, even as we find ways to articulate our disagreement in ways that make sense to us.
I've been thinking while you were talking, we've got a TV show coming up that's about Bill Hudnut, who, before he entered politics, was a Presbyterian minister. We talk with him about his faith. The show's airing this Thursday at 7:30 on the TV side on Channel 20 here. But he said at one point, which is a famous statement that, faith is a belief in the evidence of things unseen. That it sort of orders your life, and if you don't have it, you can feel somewhat adrift, which I think gets to that question that you were referring to about, is hope something real, or is it merely a delusion that helps us get through all of this? We've got time for just one quick call, and I'm going to try to squeeze it in. Ron, welcome to the program.
Yes, thank you.
Certainly. We're a little tight for time, so if I can get right to your question, thanks.
I recently was sent on Facebook a video from YouTube that discusses DNA evidence, creation versus evolution, and I was wondering from your guest if that would be included in their courses or if there was any specific comments about that. Specifically, what they point out, the first three stories of the Old Testament, Adam and Eve, the flood, and the Tower of Babel, and how DNA evidence currently or now suggests that those stories are in fact true. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Ron. We've got just a bit. That's a tough question. You've got about 45 seconds to answer.
That's a whole hour show, really.
The history of evolution. No. Just very quickly, one of the things I love about religion is that every question is connected to every other question. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine that in talking about these things, a topic like that wouldn't come up. The question of hope is intimately tied to the question of what were we created to be? I myself don't think that evolution is incompatible with the statement that God creates us with deep intention and loving purpose. But yes, I'm virtually certain that will come up in the class, which I'm looking forward to.
And again, the class is on Tuesday night, starting next Tuesday night.
Yes.
And people can go to CTS's website and register online. If they're not taking the class for credit, it's only $200?
Correct.
And what time does it start on Tuesday evening?
6:30 p.m.
6:30, and it goes until?
Around 9.
9, so it's about 2.5 hours on a Tuesday night where you're going to be talking about some heavy concepts. Well, I would like to thank both of you. I'd like to thank both of my guests, Rob Saylor and Brent Heggie, for what has been an informative and enlightening conversation. Enjoyed talking with both of you.
Thank you. Likewise.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank our listeners, as usual. Many of the most interesting questions came up here at the end. I apologize that we could not get to them on the air. Hope you will tune in again on Thursday when we are going to be talking about rad science. To find out what we're talking about there, you're going to have to listen to the show. I am John Kroll. You've been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Executive producer, Michelle Johnson. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive media coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And board engineer, Joe Hatcher. Abby Terzini screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.